Well, today we're launching into a new series called Dual Citizenship, okay? We're going to be preaching through the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew's chapters 5 through 7. This is Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, and we're going to be starting out with the Beatitudes today, which kicks off the Sermon on the Mount in verses 1 through 12. Now, to be honest, having dual citizenship is very, very hard. Right, we're calling this dual citizenship because it's a reality that we're citizens on earth, but we're also citizens of heaven. So we're to obey the law of the land and live in this particular culture, but we're also to be citizens of heaven where we have Jesus as our king reigning and ruling over us. And to be honest, isn't that tension kind of hard? Right, there's times when God's law conflicts with the law of our nation. Right, there's times when God's values conflicts with the culture's values. And we have to live right in the middle of that tension and try to figure out how to live in this time and place. And so over the next 3 months, we're going to be traveling through the Sermon on the Mount, helping us to learn what it looks like to be a citizen of heaven so that we can be better citizens on earth. Sound good? Right, that's what we're going to be diving into today. And so look with me at verses 1 through 12 of Matthew chapter 5, and we're going to start with the Beatitudes. So verse 1 says, "Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them." Now, this word mountainside is a big deal. So as you zoom out and look at the whole Gospel of Matthew as a whole, you see that Matthew is trying to do something strategic. He's laying out the scriptures in a way that would help the original readers to have some clues as to who Jesus is. And so what he's going to be doing in this whole gospel is pointing to the fact that Jesus is the new Moses, right? Because Moses was a big deal in their day. Moses was their deliverer. Moses was their lawgiver. Moses wrote the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. And so he was a big hero of theirs. And they knew that a new Moses, that a greater deliverer, someone better than he was going to show up on the scene at some point. And so for centuries, they were waiting for this deliverer. And so Matthew starts to draw some parallels between the book of Exodus and his gospel to show us, hey, that the new Moses has showed up on the scene. All right, so as you look at Exodus, you see that Moses was a guy who came up out of Egypt. As you look at the gospel of Matthew, you see that Jesus also came up out of Egypt. As you look at the book of Exodus, you see that Moses delivered the Israelites out of slavery from Pharaoh. As you look at the Gospel of Matthew, you see that Jesus delivered the world out of spiritual slavery, saved the world of our sins. As you look at the book of Exodus, you see that Moses was in the wilderness for 40 years, and that the Gospel of Matthew says that Jesus was in the wilderness for 40 days. And then lastly, we see Moses on a mountaintop in Exodus 19, receiving the law from God on a mountaintop, and then he goes and gives the law to the people. And now here in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 5, we see the Son of God also on a mountaintop, ready, giving the law to his people. And so Matthew's saying, hey, sit up, listen up. It's not just anyone that's on a mountaintop here. It's Jesus. He is the Messiah. He's the new Moses. The new deliverer has come. And so listen to him. He's the guy that we've been waiting for. And so Jesus now has his disciples huddled around him, and he decides to kick off the Sermon on the Mount by giving us the famous Beatitudes. Right, these are great Bible cup verses that we all know, right? But are really challenging to understand. Right? What does it mean to be meek? What does it mean to inherit the land? What does it mean to be poor in spirit? So they're well known, but sometimes often hard to understand to modern readers. And so we're going to talk about these today and explain them very simply to help us to understand what Jesus means. Okay? So here's the big idea today as we sort of launch into these Beatitudes. A Beatitudes comes from beatus, meaning blessed or happy. And so Jesus is going to start off his sermon by saying, hey, here's the people who are blessed. Here's the people who are truly happy. And here's the deal, is he's going to flip their expectations upside down from what they are probably used to thinking. Because the big idea this morning is that the culture's idea of who is blessed is entirely different than who God says is blessed. Right? He flipped it upside down. Who the culture thinks is blessed is entirely different than who God calls blessed. And so this morning, it's a great privilege for me to be able to preach these Beatitudes and sort of try to reorient our minds from how we've been shaped by the culture to see, no, who here are the people that Jesus calls blessed, because it's entirely different than who we would call blessed. So let me ask you guys, if someone were to ask you today, why are you blessed? What would you say? If someone were to walk up to you and say, hey, why are you blessed? What kind of answer would you give them? We might say, well, I'm blessed because I have a good family that's stable. Or I might say, because I have a good job or a good career path. Someone that might say, because I live in a good neighborhood, a safe neighborhood in the city, that's why I'm blessed. Someone might say, because I have my health, nothing's bad has gone wrong up until this point. And so those are typical answers that we might give, but let me ask you this. What about the people that don't have those things? What about the people that don't have good health right now? What about the people who have families that are falling apart? What about people that are struggling in poverty and don't have a job? Are they not blessed? There's some tension there. And what I want us to consider this morning is the fact that our culture's assumption about who is blessed and who is not could be completely wrong. So I looked it up, and on the Instagram social media site, it's true that we have used the hashtag blessed 85 million times. Yeah, 85 million times. So we are quick to call ourselves blessed, and we are quick to call certain things blessings and other things not. Right, but this morning, as citizens of heaven who worship a God in heaven and we submit to King Jesus, we want to hear from him. We want to see who he calls blessed, because it could be entirely upside down from our way of thinking. And so here are the eight groups today of people that are on God's blessed list. Here are the eight groups of people. We're going to go through them one by one through the Beatitudes. The first group that he calls blessed are the spiritually bankrupt. The spiritually bankrupt. So verse 3 says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And the commentator Charles Quarles says that the poor in spirit literally means beggarly in spirit. Beggarly in spirit, so spiritual beggars, right? All of us have seen a beggar on a street or in the middle of a street, and I'm sure if you were to think of a beggar right now, you could think of the way that their posture is. You could see that they have a dependent face, like they're needy. That you could see their humble outstretched arms looking for money to get their next meal. Or they have no protection, they have no shelter. They're literally crying out for help. They're fully dependent, not on themselves, but on someone coming and extending mercy to them. And Jesus says, the people that are blessed in my kingdom are the people who see themselves as spiritual beggars in relationship to me. They're not the people who think of themselves as independent, but rather dependent on God. Right? And so let me ask you this morning, do you see yourself primarily as a giver in God's economy, or do you see yourself as a beggar, as someone who every single day needs the grace of God in order to function and make it in this life? Because our culture, as a citizen of earth, our culture will wires us to be independent people, to be self-sufficient people, to be self-righteous people. And yet, in the kingdom of God, the people who throw off their self-righteousness, who throw off their independence, and who give themselves fully to God, laying at his feet, are the people who Jesus says will be blessed. And so we don't boast in ourselves, but we boast in the riches of God and what he can provide to us. So that's the first group of people that are blessed. The second group of people that are blessed are the spiritually broken. So look with me at verse 4. It says, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. So Jesus here is specifically pronouncing blessing on people who are mourning. And not just mourning in general. A lot of us kind of mourn the way that the world is. We mourn the state of affairs that we find ourselves in when tragedies happen on the news. But Jesus specifically is going above and beyond that. He's not just saying that people who are sad over the state of affairs in the world today. He's saying, no, blessed are the people who mourn over their sin. Blessed are those who can look inwardly and see how they have hurt God and how they have alienated themselves from God. Right? It's the people who are comforted here are the people who don't rationalize away their sin. They don't have this shallow regret for their mistakes, saying, you know, I've done some bad things in the past. But the people who will be comforted and the people who will be blessed are those who don't rationalize their sin, but have a deep sorrow over how they've affected God and negatively affected other people. Right? So let me ask you this morning, are you someone who is filled with rationalizations or remorse? Or do you find yourself making excuses, defending yourself when you're confronted, or are you the kind of person who has a broken and contrite heart? Because our culture, again, will lead us to do the opposite. Right? Self-esteem is kind of the big idea of our culture. They want you to think positively about yourself, to not look at the negative aspects of yourself. They don't want you to look inwardly, but God says, no, I'm not about self-esteem. In my kingdom, I'm about self-awareness. I want my people to not be afraid to look at themselves in the mirror, to look at the ways in which they see their attitudes and behaviors negatively affecting God and negatively affecting the people around them. He wants his people to see how they've treated their spouse, how they've treated their coworkers, how you have been harsh with your kids, and to mourn and to weep over your brokenness. And he says, those are the people that I will be quick to come and comfort and forgive and build up and edify. Right? And so, to the culture, right, people who are mourning over the state of themselves just look like people with bad self-esteem. But God says, no, they're the ones that are blessed. Well, the third group of people that are blessed are the spiritually submissive. Look with me at verse 5. It says, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. So two questions. What is a meek person, and what does it mean to inherit the earth? What's that about? Well, one commentator that I found said that a meek person, after they explored all the uses of meek in the Old Testament, they came to this conclusion, that a meek person is one who subjects himself quietly and without resistance to the Lord. So I want to ask you guys this morning, are you one who submits yourself quietly and without resistance to the Lord when he asks you to do something? So a meek person here, is that somebody who follows God kicking and screaming, right? But someone who says, hey, not my will be done, but your will be done, God. A meek person is formerly a self-willed person who wanted to make all of their decisions, who wants to follow their own path, but looks back at the course of their life and says, man, when I got my way, when I exerted my will, it went really bad in this situation. And I can actually it went bad then, and I can see another time when it went really bad. And they start to reflect on their life and saying, hey, when I followed my will, when I was on the throne of my life, it went poorly. It led to sorrow, it led to more brokenness, it led to destruction. And so now I want to wholeheartedly give myself without resistance to the Lord's will and bow down and follow him. Again, as citizens of the world teaches us to be our own authority. The world teaches us to be authority unto ourselves, to not want to listen to other people, right? But to be a citizen of heaven is to give up all of your rights to King Jesus and not resist him. This beatitude is actually a quote from Psalm 37:11. In Psalm 37:11, we see that the meek will inherit the land, which is a direct, direct quote from Psalm 37. Now, in the Old Testament, the poverty-stricken Israelite wanderers in the desert were promised that the meek would inherit the promised land of Canaan. So God says, hey, though you're submitting to me and wandering around the desert for a long time, don't worry, because someday you will get to the promised land and be able to experience the promised land of Canaan. And so for us in the New Testament context, what Jesus is probably referring to looking back is saying that the meek now will inherit the recreated earth in the age to come. Right? Which Jesus is saying is, hey, the meek in this world look very powerless, don't they? Like if you're a meek person, not a self, you know, or independent, self-righteous, have my stuff together kind of person, but if you're a meek person, you look sort of powerless to the rest of the culture. But Jesus is promising, hey, if you are meek now, if you look powerless to the world now, know that in the age to come, in the recreated earth to come, you will possess everything. That's a promise he's making to the meek. So the fourth group of people that he calls blessed are the spiritually hungry and thirsty. So verse 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Now, what kind of righteousness is he talking about here? Well, this righteousness in this context does not mean a righteousness that you earn for salvation, but it rather means a righteous character. Right? Those who are hungering and thirsting to have a righteous, godly character within that comes as a result of being a child of God. Right? So Jesus is saying here that a citizen of heaven is one who is hungering, thirsting, and longing to be a different kind of person than you are right now. You're longing to have more of Jesus saturate your heart so that you can reflect his beauty to the people around you. And I remember just being a single dude not too long ago. I've been married to my bride now for over 10 years, been happily married, but I still remember very vividly what it's like to be a single dude that just wants to have a girlfriend. I don't know if you can relate in here, but I just remember just longing to be in a relationship, and my friend would always joke with me and rebuke me, saying, Tyler, it doesn't really matter what girl you get. You just love being in love, you know? And he'd always tease me with that, and I would just always reject that. But it's true. As I look back at my life, I was longing to just have a girlfriend. And listen, it's not bad to long for a boyfriend. It's not bad to long for a girlfriend or want to be married and have a spouse. All those longings are good. But I just would recognize and admit to you guys today that being a different kind of person and longing for that was not high in my priority list. It was to just have a girlfriend, to be in a relationship. And so while those longings of relationship aren't bad, what Jesus is saying here is the people that are the most blessed, the people that are going to be blessed in the kingdom are those who long to be a different kind of person, to have a righteous character within them. That Jesus promises to bless those people. And so the culture will, again, nurture us to have longings that are in contrast to God. They'll move us and usher us to things that will give us approval, pleasure, success, security, and power. But the person who's blessed in the kingdom is those who doesn't chase after all those longings, but actually longs to be like Jesus. And so let me ask you this morning, what is your greatest longing right now? What are you hungering for? What are you thirsting for in your soul? Is it to be a different kind of person, to have godly character? And if that's the longing of your heart this morning, then God promises you that you will be filled, that you will have it. If you want to be more like him, he says, I will come and I will help you. I will give you righteousness. I will make you into a different kind of person so that you are a person of godly character and honor here on earth. So let me just make a quick note up until this point. So we've gone through the first four and have four more to go. The first four have to do with our vertical relationship with God. So blessing, pronouncements of blessing that have to do with our vertical relationship with God. And the second four, the last four, are pronouncements of blessing over a result of our horizontal relationship with others. So let's keep moving. The fifth group of people that are spiritually blessed are the spiritually merciful. So verse 7, blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Now what is mercy and what is grace? What's the simple definition for those two words that we hear all the time? Well, mercy has to do with God not punishing us, though we deserve it. And grace is God blessing us, though we don't deserve it. So whereas grace is just God is blessing us though we don't deserve it, mercy has to do with punishment. Mercy is God withholding punishment though we deserve it. And so think about a time when you didn't want to give mercy. Think about a time when you were hurt by someone. Like, how did it feel? For some of you, it's not that long ago that you've been hurt by someone. So think about, who was it? What did they do to you? And how did you want to respond? Right? Did you want to respond with mercy? Or did you respond with getting back at them, slandering them? Right? What was going on in your heart? Right? Genesis 4 tells the classic story of Cain and Abel, right? The brothers that had enmity towards each other. Cain wanted to kill his brother Abel because he was jealous. So he goes one day, kills his brother Abel in cold blood, and then God comes and talks to Cain. And in Genesis 4, verse 10, we read this. And the Lord said to Cain, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground." This is very interesting. So in this story, Abel is already passed away, and yet God says his blood is speaking. His blood is crying out from the ground. Justice. Justice for this murder. And it's crying out for justice, for revenge. It's speaking revenge. And the great Charles Spurgeon does a phenomenal job here of contrasting the blood of Abel with the blood of Christ, saying that they are saying two different kinds of things. Listen to what Charles Spurgeon says on this. He says, "And now, beloved, just contrast this," that is the blood of Abel, "with the blood of Christ. That is, Jesus Christ, the incarnate Son of God, he hangs upon a tree. He is murdered by his own brethren. He came unto his own, and his own received him not, but his own led him out to death. He bleeds, he dies. And then is heard a cry in heaven. The astonished angels again start from their seats, and they say, 'What is this? What is this cry that we hear?' And the mighty Maker answers yet again, 'It is the cry of blood. It is the cry of the blood of my only begotten and well-beloved Son.' And God, uprising from his throne, looks down from heaven and listens to the cry. And what is the cry? It is not revenge, but the voice crieth, 'Mercy, mercy, mercy.' Did you not hear it? It said, 'Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.' Herein, the blood of Christ speaketh better things than that of Abel. For Abel's blood said, 'Revenge,' but Christ's blood cried, 'Mercy.'" So we cry revenge, but Jesus cries mercy. Isn't that incredible? So to be a citizen of heaven is to be one whose gut response to being hurt is to cry the same thing as Jesus, to cry mercy, right? It's to give people what they don't deserve because Jesus gave us what we don't deserve. So I'm going to flip it around and now ask you, do you realize that you have offended people? Right? Well, all of us could say, yeah, I've been hurt, but do you realize this morning that you have hurt someone around you? That we all are repeat offenders when it comes to this. And if so, if that's the truth, if you can admit that today, what would you want the person whom you've hurt to say back to you? Would you want their cry to be justice, revenge? Or would you like them to look at you as one who is covered by the blood of Christ and for you to hear Jesus' cry for mercy over you? That's what it looks like to be a citizen of heaven. And Jesus is saying, here, the good news, disciples, is that if you are someone who doesn't cry out revenge when hurt, but mercy, that in the end, when you see Jesus face to face, that he will speak mercy over you. So the sixth group of people that Jesus calls blessed here on the mountaintop are the spiritually pure. So verse 8 says, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God." Right? What does pure in heart mean? Well, later on in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, he says something very provocative. Now, Jesus says a lot of provocative things, but this is very provocative and very hard. It's a hard pill to swallow. So in verse 20 of Matthew chapter 5, he says, "For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter into the kingdom of heaven." Right? We all listened to Carl's sermon last week, which is very depressing for most of it. Ecclesiastes, life is meaningless. It was a hard pill to swallow. And this is another hard pill to swallow because the scribes and Pharisees of that day were the religious leaders. They were the pastors. So Jesus is saying here is unless your righteousness and holiness exceeds that of these religious leaders, there's no way you're getting into heaven. Unless you're better than these pastors, there's no way you're getting into heaven. Imagine how deflating that would have been to hear that. Well, then how in the world do I get into heaven, into the kingdom? And what he's saying is the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees are not enough. Why? Because they are spiritual phonies. Right? God said that they are whitewashed tombs that only care about the outside of their lives rather than the inside of their lives. They care nothing about internal purity. They don't want to be a different kind of person. They don't want to grow in holiness. They only care about what other people think of them. And honestly, that's pretty typical of being a citizen of this earth, of this culture, right? We're taught how to manage our external appearance. We're taught how to manage our outward behavior and to neglect the inside of our hearts, the purity of our hearts. And yet what God is calling us as citizens of heaven is to care about moral integrity, to be people of moral integrity. Author Alan Cohen gives just a great definition when he says that you know you have moral integrity when the life you're living on the outside matches who you are on the inside, right? When there's no gap there, when who you are on the outside matches who you are on the inside. So City Light Benson, would you say that your public life and what you put on your public profile matches your private life? That's the challenge. Do we spend more time confessing sin to others or do we spend more time concealing our sin from others? Like, do we care about what's on the inside? If you do, if you're the kind of person that confesses sin and wants to walk in holiness, that Jesus says, you will be blessed. You will be blessed. How? Well, in Psalm 24, it talks about the pure in heart, which is probably what Jesus is quoting here. It says that the pure in heart are those who seek the face of God, the God of Jacob. So what Jesus is most likely saying here is that when the pure in heart will see God, he's saying that the pure in heart will get what they want. But if you're somebody who's pure in heart, you want to seek God's face. You don't want to see him dimly, but you want to see his face clearly. You want to see his beauty and all of his glory. And Jesus says, if you are pursuing purity, you are going to get what you want. That someday you're going to be able to see Jesus as clear as day and revel in his beauty as you stand and see him face to face. You will get what you want. All right, the seventh group of people who are called blessed by Jesus are the spiritual peacemakers. Look at verse 9. It says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God." You see, at first the disciples had a wartime mentality. Like they thought that when the Messiah came and the new king came in the line of David, that he would set up a physical kingdom here on earth. And they were at the time being oppressed by the Romans. So they were waiting, hey, if this guy is going to show up after centuries of being oppressed, we can't wait for that day because we want the Romans to go down. We want the physical kingdom to rise up. And so we're going to fight with whoever king shows up on the scene. And so they had their swords there. And Jesus is saying, no, not yet. Right? What I'm calling you to is a different kind of ministry. I'm not calling you to be war makers, but I'm calling you to be peacemakers. Or to be people of peace. Anne Spangler is an author, and she writes this beautiful definition of what a person of peace is. She says, "A person of peace has a non-anxious presence. That is, the one person in the room who maintains a peaceful presence when everyone around them is losing it. When a child has died, when a couple is on the verge of divorce, when someone is in despair, they are to be present in a way that reorients the emotional and spiritual atmosphere." Right? Instead of becoming enmeshed in the emotional atmosphere, getting sucked in by the frustration, the fear, or anger that is swirling around them, they are able to maintain their equilibrium. It's a person of peace. I love that. A peacemaker is someone who has a non-anxious presence, who doesn't run from conflict, nor add fuel to the conflict. Rather, they are active in putting out fires around them with God's peace. So let me ask you, church, in the midst of conflict, do you typically run? Do you typically put up your fists and fight? Or do you make peace? Right? A citizen of heaven is neither one who runs away passively or someone who runs into the fire, throwing fuel on the fire. You know, they see conflicts and they see arguments on Facebook and they're just commenting and adding fuel to the fire and the negative rhetoric. But they're ones who try to bring and usher in the peace of God through the power of the Holy Spirit. And Jesus says that these people would be called sons of God, children of God. What does he mean? Is not every Christian a child of God? No, he's saying, yeah, every Christian is a child of God. Every Christian is adopted by God and is called a son or daughter. But these people in particular, like when you see in your workplace, you see in your family, during times of family drama over Christmas, like when you see these people working for peace, stepping up for peace, it's self-evident that they're children of God. Right? It's easy to point your finger at them and say that right there, because of what they're doing, is a child of God, because it'll be self-evident. Well, lastly, the final group of people that Jesus calls blessed are the spiritually persecuted. Look at verse 10 through 12. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before you. This is a hard pill to swallow, friends, that for every Christian, right, no matter what place you live in, whether it's America or China, whether it was in the second century or 21st century, every Christian that has ever lived will always face resistance. Always. That is a fact. Jesus didn't say if you're persecuted, but he said to them when you're persecuted. Why? Well, there's two reasons that Jesus points out. In verse 10, he says that we'll be persecuted because of righteousness. And what he means by that is you'll be persecuted because of your Christian conduct. So apart from evangelism, apart from sharing your faith and stirring the pot on your floor around your cubicle at work, right? Apart from all that kind of work, he says you will just be persecuted because of the way you live, right? Because in every culture, in every century, no matter where you're living, your Christian conduct will always come into resistance with the culture you're living in. But even if you think about our culture, right, we believe as Christians that you don't shack up before marriage, that you honor the marriage bed and you wait to have sex before you're married. That is countercultural. Right? We are a church that believes that you don't get drunk, but respect the gift of alcohol. We have different views on sexuality than the culture has, and so on. And so just by living as a Christian, Jesus says, you are going to incite mistreatment from the people around you. It could be even your family members. But either way, expect to be mistreated. And then secondly, the second reason why we'll be persecuted in verse 11, Jesus says, just because of me, because of my name. Like if you name the name of Jesus to the people around you and are persuading people around you to follow him and bow their knee to him, people will insult you. Like people will insult you, and people will even make false accusations. They will lie about you. Right? The religious leaders called Jesus a glutton and a drunkard. Right? People will just spatter all kinds of false things about you, and we are to expect that as Christians. It's hard for us as Americans because we live in a very prosperous country. It's very comfortable. We're pretty safe. And so we, out of any Christian who've ever lived, are going to be tempted to call this our permanent home. But that's not the case. We don't call this home because we are citizens of heaven. Our home resides somewhere else. And we are to fight to bring Jesus to this world. You know, it's very interesting that Jesus ends the Beatitudes with this, the blessing, his pronouncement of blessing over the persecuted, because he looked at every one of their faces and realized and could foresee that they would all die for him. That all of them would, upon seeing Jesus on a cross, dying for their sins, and then seeing him raised from the dead, would believe in him, that he was the Messiah, and they would give their very lives for him. We learn from the scriptures that James was beheaded. And we learn from church tradition, church writings in the past, that the others were killed as well. We see that Peter was crucified upside down in Rome by Nero. We see that Andrew was crucified in Greece. We see that Philip was crucified at Hierapolis. We see that Thomas was run through with a spear in India. We see that Matthew was slain with a halberd, which is a battle axe and pike mounted on a handle about 6 feet long over in Ethiopia. We see that Bartholomew was crucified in India. We see that James, the son of Alphaeus, was stoned in Jerusalem. We see that Simon was crucified in Britain. And we see that Thaddeus was crucified in Edessa. So these men that Jesus was preaching a sermon to, pronouncing blessing over them, that, hey, if you're persecuted, you will have a reward in heaven. He could see what was going to happen to them. He was going to see that these men were going to give their very lives for him, that they were going to scatter from that mountaintop to every region and every corner of the world, as we see in Ethiopia, in Greece, in India. They were going to scatter across the world to give their lives to proclaiming the name of Jesus. And that's what James Roscup says. These men spent the rest of their lives proclaiming the message of the resurrection. As cowards transformed into men of courage, they were willing to face arrest, imprisonment, beating, and horrible deaths. And not one of them ever denied the Lord and recanted of his belief that Christ had risen. And so, many people over the centuries will look back at these disciples and say, what a wasted life. Like, those men were not blessed. Like, look what happened to them. They were martyred. That's not blessing. That feels like a curse. And yet Jesus wanted to promise them in that circle on that mountaintop. He said, no, I call you blessed. You are blessed in my eyes. Right? The present sufferings that we have and that you will have after this, know that though you will have present sufferings, my future reward will be much, much greater. That in heaven, my future reward will outlast and be something you can't even comprehend. And I will call you blessed. So remember, the big idea of this sermon is that who the world calls blessed is entirely different than who God calls blessed. And so I want to encourage you, as you enter into a time of communion this morning, that you would just look back at this list that I've given you today. Look back at these Beatitudes and try to reorient your thinking about blessings in your own life, thinking about why you're blessed, and to see if it matches up with God's list of people that are blessed. Right? And I want to greatly encourage you, and I want to end on a very positive note this morning, because these Beatitudes are pronouncements of blessing. These Beatitudes are not actually a to-do list of things that you need to do in order to be delivered by Jesus. No, Jesus has already delivered us. Right? Just as the Israelites received the Ten Commandments and the law from Moses after they had been delivered through the Red Sea out of Egypt, so we receive these Beatitudes after we know that we've been delivered by King Jesus. And so these Beatitudes are essentially the good news before Jesus gets to the good advice and the rest of the Sermon on the Mount. These Beatitudes are a pronouncement of good news that, hey, if these things are true about you, if you're a son and daughter of God that's seeking to be a merciful person, that's seeking to be poor in spirit, that's seeking to be dependent on God and submissive without resistance to his will. If you see those things and that they're true of you today, know that Jesus calls you blessed. That though the world may look at you and pity you and think of you as not blessed, hear the words of Jesus over the disciples and over our ears this morning, that you are blessed. And take comfort in that this morning.